for those people who've done the Thanksgiving retreat. They are probably familiar with the routine. Today we start shifting into giving others the opportunity to give some reflections on Dhamma. And this year we have Ajahn Sudhanto with us, who's the senior monk, head monk, abbot at Pacific Hermitage, White Salmon, Washington. He was one of the early members of Bhai Giri and helped out for many, many years, and has been leading the community up in White Salmon now for 5 years, 6 years? Yeah, six. So I invite Ajahn Sudhanto to give some reflections.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami.
So this afternoon we start the variety hour. After lunch session is always a little bit of a challenge, getting the energy going again. Maybe just first start off with a few comments. It's really nice to be here. I probably haven't participated in one of these Thanksgiving retreats for 15 years or so, long enough that I'm not quite sure that I ever did. I was trying to think what year it was. I'm sure I did, but I also know the characteristic of memory is highly fallible. And maybe I just came and helped set up 1 year. A long time ago. And if memory serves me right, it was with Ajahn Amro in this same hall here. But it's nice to be back, and there's quite a few old friends and familiar faces here on the retreat. And it's quite a special retreat because it's been going on for so many years. And there aren't many monastic retreats like this where you gather together with such a group of monastics and morning and evening chantings and a variety of Dhamma talks. So when I was planning my year, this was something that I set out to do. Was very much kind of looking forward to. And then as I started to sort of plan my calendar, I thought, well, it might be nice to also give some exposure to it too. Our friends in the White Salmon and Portland community. And so it's also nice to have quite a group from up there joining us for this retreat. So there's about 10 or 11 of us, depending if you count Ajahn Krunadamo. It's debatable where he belongs in the roster, but... also about 20%. So it's nice. And despite the bottomless abyss of pain, the sun is shining. So but it's quite a blessing. Several of the monastics and Hitesi, who's managing the retreat, commented on just how quickly and profoundly everyone seems to have settled into the retreat space, and I think it's a testament to the hard work and the years of practice. It certainly was very noticeable to myself even the first night or through the first day coming into the hall here and just seeing how settled everyone seems, and And I'm sure we all have our pain. But Dhamma practice has this ability to ennoble the heart, and in some ways it gives us the strength to bear with it in a way that is graceful. If not transformative and transcendent. And I'm kind of given to imagery. I was quite struck by that allusion that Lumbor made earlier. And I thought, wow, that's kind of dark, you know, especially when you think about chronic pain or how persistent pain is. And it really is such an integral part of the human condition. I often find when I'm kind of scanning my body and my mind, asking myself what is it that's obstructing peace and a greater sense of spaciousness in my experience, I often find myself frustrated or arguing with the pain of the body or the pain that's intrinsic to the human experience. And kind of, you know, stuck in some sort of loop or pattern, sort of hoping, wishing, wanting for it to somehow just dissipate or to be released. And certainly part of the cultivation of samatha in our meditation is to learn how to release it. So it's not wrong to be sort of attending to it and working with it, but there is a right way and a wrong way, and it certainly seems wrong when it's threaded with this sort of sense of, well, a sense that it's somehow not fair, or the mind is kind of overcome with some unreasonable desire to be free from it forevermore. And it's often sort of amazing to me that by just turning the mind towards pain as an inevitable part of this sort of process, and opening to acceptance, how it changes the relationship with it. I sometimes come up with this sort of analogy. It's like this kind of dog sort of chewing on this piece of rawhide or bone or something, looking for some sense of nourishment or satisfaction. And it seems to match the kind of emotional tone that I feel when I'm sort of sitting there. I'm trying to sort of develop the meditation and tending to trying to purify the mental experience of the meditation, and the pain is there, just kind of sort of cycling or circling around, and I'm kind of stuck in these loops of wishing, wanting, desiring for freedom from it, and then all of a sudden just turning to it and saying, it is, this is, and in some sense part of this belongs in the human experience, and it's sort of futile to argue with it or split it off in some way or personalize it. And, you know, one thing that also I find helps immeasurably is, and I've been working with over the last couple of years, is developing some practices around the cultivation of contentment and gratitude. And if pain is a bottomless abyss, I like to think of contentment and gratitude as a bottomless well. And it's kind of an endless sort of source of lightness and solace that doesn't necessarily obliterate or fill the bottomless abyss, but it slacks that kind of thirst. And there always, when I think and even talk about it, one of the ways I try to approach it is trying to always break it down to something that is the most fundamental, the ability to feel contentment and gratitude for the very simplest things. Maybe one of the obstructions for developing this as a practice before is, you know, I tended to think about it in big and grand ways. Like, sure, I'd be content and gracious if I had mastered the jhanas, or if I was enlightened already, or I had this skill or that aptitude. But really, it's just a motion or a movement of heart, and it seems to run so counter to the problem of desire. The problem of dukkha is this dissonance that's created from the perception of lack, the heaviness that accompanies this ingratitude, or the sense that life owes us something that we're not getting, or there's this distance between where we are and where we need to be or want to be. And contentment has a way of just kind of turning that whole thing around. Instead of there being this distance between where we are and what we want, you're looking for what's right here, what's accessible, what's immediate. So you can just acknowledge the sense of beauty and graciousness of a few rays of sunlight, and it's kind of heightened after a couple of days of heavy rains, or warm, quiet building full of good friends and Kalyanamita to practice with, the space. The space, the time, the encouragement, and the structure to engage in this practice. That recollection and remembrance of precious opportunity that it is. I said earlier, I haven't been here for 15 years, so I'm not sure I'll be here for another. It is precious. And the tendency of the mind is always orient itself in that pattern of desire, wishing, wanting, imagining what could be. It's like, you know, it's a retreat like this. I'm sure most of you were very much looking forward to it. And now a couple days into it, that sense is probably dissipated. and so then there's probably still plenty of other forward-looking thoughts that you have, but in an hour, we're in the kind of free zone to sort of take it for granted that we're here, or seize upon what it is that isn't to our liking. Maybe the body's not cooperating, meditation isn't flowing quite as one expected it to. Could be a numerous kind of responses. But just turning the mind around and finding something that's very immediate, simple, concrete, here and now, sense of safety, warmth, the relative comfort and health that we do have. Even taking it down to just this breath. Having practiced breath meditation for a number of years, the breath now seems like this. Also, like a bottomless well or something. And when I'm there for it, and the heart is in a relatively balanced kind of posture or something, I can arouse tremendous gratitude just for this breath. It's just the most amazing experience when you're fully there for it. I sometimes have memories of this emphysemic man who was on my paper route when I was a little boy. And I don't know if kids still do this. Probably not, because they don't have newspapers so much. It was just amazing at the time, though, what my parents would let us do. And I remember every month, at the end of the month, we had to ride around on our bikes and collect all the money. And this one man, he'd go up to his house and park my bike and start walking up to his front door. And even before I could get to the front door, I'd hear him inside sort of coughing. And he'd shuffle up to the door. And he wasn't that old, but he certainly looked it. And he opened the door and you could smell years of pipe tobacco that had absorbed into the wallpaper or something, carpet. And he'd always be struggling for breath. And I remember just being struck by that and thinking, what a hell realm that must be. To be without kind of free and unobstructed breath. Or, in even a more mundane sense, when we've been through a period of sickness or cold or something, congested for many days, and get back to breathing freely, which we oftentimes long for several days ahead of time. At first morning you wake up and you're clear, you think, oh God, it's so nice, just a fresh, clean, unobstructed breath. So nice. But the habits of wanting and desire generally kind of overstrip connecting with it in that way, and we're off to the races wishing and wanting for something else. Back to taking it for granted. So that was interesting, listening to Lumbur talk about pain and dealing with chronic pain. And I don't know why, but I've always had the perception of Lumbur as probably one of the healthiest people I know, and simultaneously jinxed by bad bodily karma. He's never far from the next health crisis. but he bears it well. he doesn't complain much. And he works hard taking care of himself. Harder than most. But there's a couple of things I found out when I was ordaining in Thailand, and this happened previous to my time, but he holds the record for the most number of times one can get malaria in the rainy season. I don't know, it's like 6 or 9, or maybe it just never went away. All while living in the jungle on Burmese border, where there's no ready healthcare. So. He already told you he broke his hip, fractured his pelvis. In the early part of the retreat, Lumbur was talking quite broadly about practice. And I think that's nice, especially in a retreat where you have quite a few mature practitioners. It's easy sometimes to think about a 10-day retreat in a way that's very focused or kind of narrow or focused around particular techniques or particular goals. And it's nice to have this kind of time to come together and support each other in such a supportive environment, to deepen our practice and to make those broader sort of connections, and ultimately, in the broadest sense, we're students of dukkha. And pain and the pain of the body are just kind of one sort of manifestation of that. You know, in thinking about practice, the two aspects of the path that always I keep finding myself coming back to and trying to encourage myself in are right view and right effort. And I think in the broadest sense, that's the framework for our overall practice and even in a period of retreat, it's important to have that frame sort of there and present it in some way, even if we're working in some sort of particular way or with particular goals. It's important always to map it into this sort of bigger project of being a student of dukkha and trying to really connect with it and learn from it. Oftentimes I think about it as like mapping it into our experience. It's easy to oftentimes think about it in ways that are quite abstract. You know, in this day and age, there's such a wealth of Dhamma books and Dhamma talks, and many of you are avid sort of students. And in my own personal experience, I've lived as a monk for quite a number of years now, and I find it baffling in some sense how difficult it is to really fully kind of inhabit this in a position of being a sincere student of dukkha and kind of connecting with it. There's this tendency of voice to sort of think about suffering in a very abstract way. You know, and the most abstract way is to just identify with being somebody who's bound by dukkha and obstructed by dukkha. Or identify with sort of, I'm an unenlightened person, and by engaging in Dhamma practice, hopefully with lots of hard work, someday I'll rectify that situation and become the enlightened person, free from dukkha. And those ways of thinking don't necessarily need to be abstract, but typically this way we relate to them. And to sort of rectify that, I oftentimes just try to sort of shake myself and say, come on, Sudanto, get real or get sincere. Sort of like, where's the suffering sort of here and now? What is it that is obstructing you? And there's different ways to think of it. There's different ways to sort of approach it. In the context of practice, sometimes just come to sort of a spatial sort of sense of what's going on with the mind. Ajahn Sonoy talks about the five hindrances as this nice way of talking about it, where the different hindrances or movements of the mind. So you can think of this, the mind that is free of hindrances, something that is balanced and sort of centered. And the hindrances are things that are you're trying to sort of, experiences you're trying to pull towards you or push away from you. Or the mind's floating up or sinking down or spinning around. So kama, chanda, that sort of sense that there's a distance between you and where you want to be, or you and the sensual experiences that you want to be in the midst of or enjoying, is, creates this kind of sense of thirsting and reaching and grasping, and there's this dissonance or this tension as you're longing for something other than what you're experiencing. And that's a state of dukkha. It can be subtle or it can be profound, but there's this sense of otherness, and there's this sense of dissonance or wrongness or incompleteness when the heart is disposed in that way. And aversion is the opposite sort of motion, where the unwanted, unwished for thought, emotion, sensation, sound, physical state, person, situation, and we're stuck in this posture of pushing or wanting to push. And restlessness, sort of floating up, bubbling up, moving away from sort of center. And that's particularly kind of pernicious one when we're approaching sort of meditation. Difficult to settle in a profound way. That sort of bubbly mind, the mind that is constantly floating away here and there. Sloth and torpor, a kind of sinking or mental lethargy. I often think of sinking into darkness. Darkness, dullness, lethargy. Just a kind of laziness of mind. And in particular, sort of about in a period of retreat where you're doing lots of meditation, there's these blank zones where you're kind of meditating, but the mind just feels kind of flat. Maybe you're not really asleep or in darkness or nodding, but the kind of energy we want, the kind of centeredness, the kind of crispness and aliveness is not there. Or the will is not there. And you know something's kind of off, but you just can't sort of constellate the right kind of energy to re-engage the mind, or to even search for sort of what it is that the mind's kind of missing. What are the missing ingredients? Or you know you should get up, or you know you should open your eyes, but instead you just wait for the bell. And doubt is a kind of spinning around. Maybe I should do metta. No, I'll go back to the breath. No, maybe I should do a subhakamatana. Maybe I should sit. Maybe I should walk. Maybe I shouldn't have come. Okay, indecisiveness. I think it gets even really sort of subtle, like, even in the midst of practice, it is this whole kind of dynamic sort of balancing act, trying to sort of put forth effort and cultivate various energies and various states of mind. And there are choices to be made. And oftentimes we can get sort of stuck in even subtle sort of doubts, just flipping around from this to that, instead of coming up with just some clear strategy and then really applying ourselves to it with a sense of purpose and energy. So these movements of the mind as contrasted with something that is balanced, still, centered, complete. I like to think of wholesome states, and in particular the absence of suffering as this state of completeness that we're looking for. And ultimately the job of the practitioner really comes down to being this sincere sort of student of dukkha, where we're caring for ourselves in a way where we have the supports and the energy and the requisites to examine our hearts and our minds in a way that is sincere. And we look for that which is creating dissonance, creating a sense that life is problematic, and creating this, the awareness that we've drifted from some sort of place of peace and centeredness. And we engage then in right practice. We engage in right effort. And in the broadest sense, that sort of effort to awaken to and understand suffering map it to our experience, as I said, how we do suffering, and then putting forth effort to bring the various obstructions and negative states of mind to resolve, and the kind of effort to lift the mind up and to cultivate and develop and strengthen the things that help bring us back to a place free of dissonance and moving towards that sense of completeness and a profound sense of well-being, a profound sense of life, not just being okay, but being something that isn't problematic. Our life's goal as practitioners should be to arrive to the place where we can say sincerely and honestly to ourselves that there is no problem. So I'll offer that for your reflection this afternoon.